Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. Last week, in the first week of Advent, we looked at how God used Empire Babylon to punish disobedient Judah. And we saw how Habakkuk was sort of in the middle of this thing. And we saw the promise of Jesus. This is what Advent is about. Now, it sort of reached a climax when Habakkuk notes that, does it really make much sense to punish Judah for her idolatry and her injustice by using Babylon, which is more idolatrous and more unjust than even little Judah? And God says to Habakkuk this, "See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples." Picked up a great quote. It was actually in one of the little quotes that each episode of Borgen begins with. It's attributed to Abraham Lincoln, but the internet says, no, he probably didn't say it, but it was said of him. "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." It's basically a nice little short saying that summarizes what Habakkuk 2:4-5 says. In the book of Esther, the story begins with King Xerxes of the Persians. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. Now, those of you who know the book of Daniel know that really leaning into the glory of your riches and power as an emperor might not lead you to good places. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet, lasting 7 days, in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. The gates had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. In other words, this is the peak. This is the height. You don't get any higher in Persia than this. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. Now, you'll find there's nothing against feasting and nothing against celebration. You won't find this sort of taken away, but it can get to a point. And if it becomes you, it can get bad. "By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions. For the king's instructions, all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished." Now again, remember what Habakkuk said. "Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest." Is this where Xerxes is going? "Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was high in spirits from wine," his wine is betraying him, "he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown." Was she wearing anything else? "In order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at." Well, Queen Vashti, I'm going to skip some of this, and many of you know the story of Esther. Queen Vashti was not having it and said, ain't doing it. And, well, didn't go well. So what does, well, I should probably add that in here. So when Vashti refuses to come, basically the other nobles say, "Look, if you let her get away with this, our wives will do the same thing because she's the status maker. So why don't you instead decide to give one of these edicts. Now, this will set up a pattern in the book where these lesser people basically tell the king what to do, and the king listens to them and follows them, and, well, it doesn't go well. So send an edict and basically fire her as queen, and, you know, and then all of our wives will respect us too. I don't think they're giving very good marriage advice here, but there it is. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what he had decreed about her, that basically she couldn't come into his presence again. He, in a sense, divorced her, made her dead to him, and because the law couldn't be revoked, he had to stick with it and no more Vashti, and after the wine was gone, he missed her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed another idea. Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners to every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem of the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. So in other words, lost one, get another to replace her. This idea appealed to the king, and so he followed it. Again, you're seeing a pattern develop. Now, the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women. So a young Jewish girl gets brought up into the dragnet of young women, and Esther it is. And she was the favorite of the king. And she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all of his nobles and officials, and he proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. Now, it's an interesting story. It's a terrific story, in fact. But part of what's interesting about this book is that the name of the Lord doesn't appear once in it. And this sort of sets up the question, is God absent? Will God forget his people? Has God forgotten his people? Now, you might remember, if you go all the way back to Exodus, the people forgot God. And, well, Esther just seems to be part of the whole community serving the king. And here it is. But yet, isn't God behind the scenes in some ways? Who gave Esther her beauty? Why did she win favor? When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, there's a plot that went on, but Esther had kept her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, a secret, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when she was bringing her up. Mordecai was her uncle. During this time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, as you'll notice, I'm skipping around the book because it would just take a long time to read the whole book as is, but I very much recommend that you, in fact, read the whole book. It's not a long read, and it's a great, great story that you will enjoy. During the time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and two of the king's high officials who guarded the gate became angry and conspired to assassinate the king. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, two officials were impaled on poles. This will be another pattern in the book. All of this was recorded in the Book of Annals in the presence of the king. Now, what this begins to set up in the book is a strange tension between those not subject to the empire and the best subjects of the empire. Because, of course, the people of God, well, they're pretty much just part of this empire, and Xerxes isn't a follower of God. And so, in a strange way, you begin to have this setting that the Jews are distinguished, and we're going to see that a little bit later when there's Haman's plot to destroy them. They want to be pushed out of the empire by death, or at least subjugated or marginalized, but they themselves, in fact, are the best subjects of the empire, and we'll see this happen again and again. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor highest than that of all the other nobles. So in just the court of the course of the court, king picks this Haman, and he's an Agagite. These were people that God had commanded to be wiped out, and Saul flinched. And, well, he's at the top of the chain. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded him this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. And this is what I mean by this theme of not subject to the empire, but best subjects of the empire. Mordecai wouldn't bend the knee to Haman, and Haman wasn't having it. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, because, of course, this is how the empire works. Kiss up, kick down, and now Mordecai is refusing to kiss up. For he had told him that he was a Jew. Now we're going to be segregated by their ethnicity, nationality. Now, in some ways, all of these terms are a little bit anachronistic, but you get the idea. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him homage, he was enraged. Why? Because that's the way the chain works. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. In other words, if you really want to get at someone, don't just kill him, kill his entire family. And of course, families are considered to be very, very large, just sort of the whole nation, the whole kin group, the whole ethnicity. Why not get rid of all of them? Because, and this is a long history of anti-Semitism, where they're different. They're different from the rest of the empire. They don't fit in. They, in fact, stand out. They're in the empire, but not of it, let's say. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the poor, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. When Haman said to King Xerxes, "There's a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all of the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other peoples, and they do not obey the king's law. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them." Now, again, we've seen they're not of it, but they're the best. They're not subject to it, but they're the best subjects of it. There's that tension. "If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver." That is a huge amount of silver. "To the king's administrators for the royal treasury." Wow, what a wonderful system. What a wonderful empire. We have all of these people giving really bad ideas to the king, and the king just sort of laps it up. And now, well, money on top of that too. So, king says, "Great idea. Let's do it." Well, this gets reported back to Esther. So Mordecai hears about this. He says, "Esther, you're going to have to do something about this, or we're all toast." Then she instructed him to tell Mordecai, "All of the king's officials and people of the royal provinces know that of any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law, that they will be put to death unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives." So in other words, really hard to see this guy. "But 30 days have passed since I was called to the king." What she's meaning is he's found another little lovely from the harem that he prefers to Esther. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." Isn't this interesting? God's name is not found, but Mordecai certainly believes in God's hand on his people, even in the midst of Persia. And, well, he puts it in front of Esther. "And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" In other words, Esther, you need to do something. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." She's willing to put her neck on the line for the salvation of her people. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city. Now, so then this whole thing plays out, and there's Haman and the couch and all kinds of different things that goes on. Basically, Haman gets put up on the gallows, on the pole, impaled on his pole instead of Mordecai, and so they win. But then the problem is, what will they do about the edict? Aren't the Jews still in trouble because you can't change it? So they need a new edict. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all of the provinces was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. In other words, the day before. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as a law in every province and made to the people of every nationality so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves of their enemies. I'm sorry, I was wrong. It's the day after. In other words, they get to respond to the attack. When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing a royal garment of purple and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. Now, why is this happening? Clearly, they are signaling to everyone that not Haman, but now Mordecai is second in command. And so maybe you better be a little bit careful about what you do with Mordecai's kin. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city in which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebration, and many of the people in other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. So in other words, on the 12th day, you can go and attack Jews if you want to, but on the 13th day, they're going to get revenge. Mordecai's in charge. Everybody's seeing the way that the flow is going. And so remember, kiss up, kick down. Oh, I want to be a Jew too. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. And on this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned and the Jews had the upper hand over those who hated them. And the Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the nationalities were afraid of them. You very much have echoes of all their stories in the Old Testament where Israel would triumph over their enemies and others would live in fear of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps and the governors and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. In other words, the power of the empire is working. But remember how this story started? What kind of an empire is this? Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he was more and more powerful. Now, again, in the book of Daniel, you'll read a common stories like this, where Daniel rises to the height, and then the next chapter, he's sort of down again. And so your stock rises and falls in the royal court. That much is true. But notice in some ways, Mordecai is not just in the empire, but not of it. He's now at the center of it. Mordecai is really a messianic figure. He delivers God's people from their enemies, and by the power of the sword, God's people triumph over their enemies, and it's something worth celebrating. It's a joyful thing. I'm not taking anything away from that, but please notice, Mordecai is using the power of the empire. The power dynamics of the empire has not been transformed. It's just been carried through. This is in many ways the Old Testament definition of Messiah. This is what Messiahs do. our well-being at your expense. The welfare of the Jews at the expense of the others, which is on the opposite because according to Haman, it was supposed to be the welfare of the Jewish enemies at the expense of the Jews. Now, of course, God wouldn't let this happen. And also you have to a certain degree this dynamic of kind of karma where, well, now the Jews are lifted up at the expense of their enemies. And again, this is a joyful thing. It's worth celebrating. God's people were preserved. It's wonderful. But remember empire. Remember what we talked about with respect to it. Now, I'm not saying something as simplistic as empire bad, but empire is complex. And when you look at how this works, you have to pause and say, was Mordecai now finally in some ways assimilated into the empire? What type of Messiah will Mordecai be? Now, there's no reason to believe from the text that he was a bad Messiah. There's no reason to believe that he did anything unjust. There's no reason to believe that Mordecai did anything wrong. But nearly all men can stand adversity. But if you really want to test a man's character, give him power. Will Mordecai now suffer from what happens to those in power? Will he be filled with wine? Will he be drunk with power? Now, the story doesn't go there. The story just ends on a good note, and it's a happy story, and it's a good note, and there's a celebration, and the celebration is commemorated, and it is worth celebrating, just like any 4th of July is worth celebrating as Independence Day. And again, I'm not taking anything away from that. I'm not trying to say that that is evil or bad. But what's interesting is it is not like Jesus. What we see with Jesus is a transformation, because everyone would expect that Jesus as the Son of God would ride down on a golden chariot like Apollo and have arrows to strew among the battlefields to kick out the Romans from God's holy land and deliver God's holy people from that tyranny. But that's not what he does. A different kind of Messiah will be needed, not just to take over empire and to use its tools to defeat evil, but one who would defeat those tools themselves. Notice the contrast between Mordecai and Jesus. Everyone expects and wants Jesus, with the kind of divine power he demonstrated in his miracles, to do what Mordecai did. But Jesus does not. A better Mordecai and Esther, because, of course, in some ways, Esther is the picture of Jesus here too. It's Esther that risks her life for the deliverance of her people. A better Mordecai and Esther would arise to share with the rest of the world what God's chosen people had suffered and would triumph through. How does this work? How does this Messiah conquer? It's interesting that Jesus, in many ways, added something completely different to the story. In Jesus, we see a Messiah who saves his people, like Mordecai does so, well, not just at the risk of his life, like Esther, but at the cost of his life, and manages to save Romans too. Manages to save the enemies of God while they're still his enemies and move them towards himself. People don't become Christians just because they fear other Christians, we hope. They become Christians because they see something of Jesus in those Christians. Now we await the coming of the Messiah. In his first coming, he came to absorb wrath, not to strike fear in his enemies. While we were yet sinners, ignorant of the mercy of God, he gave himself up. This is my body, broken for you. This is my blood, shed for you.